Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. As my guest, I have one of the beloved writers in American life. She has been on the show going back to its very origins around 32 years ago. It's a pleasure to talk to Louise Erdrich once again about her marvelous book, The Sentence, which is published by HarperCollins. Now, Louise, this book seems to come out of thin air. It's a ghost story mystery, and I know of nothing else in your work that's like it. How did you come upon it?
Oh, well, first of all, I have to say what a vast pleasure it is to talk to you again. I'm smiling over here in Minneapolis, and I'm excited to talk about this book. I got this idea a while ago, and I kept trying to write it. Bookstores seem haunted. Bookstores, maybe not the new brightly lighted bookstores that are wonderful as well, but for me, it's the cramped, eccentric, the bookstore that has the books that go up to the ceiling and that you find in small towns sometimes, or tucked away in corners of the city that you've never experienced. Those are the kind of bookstores that I feel are my favorites, and that I feel this sense of haunting. And the haunting, I think, comes naturally through books, because we're always surrounded by these consciousnesses that we can open to at any time, and we can connect with the living, the dead, all in this little space.
For years, I worked in what was one of the best bookstores in Los Angeles. It was called Papa Bach Books. Papa Bach was a elaborated way of saying paperback. It specialized in paperbacks of every kind. This was the first bookstore I knew that you could go to and find books that were from university presses and poetry presses. And Louise, I swear, I would go home at night and then come in the next morning to find books on the shelf that hadn't been there the night before. It's an amazing thing.
I know. It's a living place. The bookstore itself is alive, and the interactions between the books and people, 2 days are 2 hours, 2 minutes are never the same in a bookstore.
Well, I love it, because I do think that every bookstore is a haunted bookstore. The bookstore in Louise Erdrich's new novel, The Sentence, is certainly a haunted bookstore, but you have shelves of different consciousnesses that would perhaps have never known or met each other anywhere else, whether it's philosophers and poets and scientists. The bookstore is full of the representation of our haunted world. Many of our most wonderful and beloved writers are among the dearly departed. I have dreams about all kinds of writers all the time. Certain of my beloved writers have passed away. Writers, say, like Carlos Fuentes or Sabolt, or Susan Sontag, or William Gass. These were people I came to know in the course of working in a bookstore and doing this particular radio show, because this radio show, as far as I'm concerned, is literary. And in this book, The Sentence, the book seems to be an expression of a very constant aspect of your life. The reading, the buying, the selling of books becomes central to this book. And I think that any of us who regard ourselves as readers would love Louise Erdrich's The Sentence.
It is about what you're calling the flow of books. We're not algorithms in a bookstore. We've read the books. And there's also this wonderful sense of chance flowing through the great river that I love, that contains books and buyers and customers, and that is this this wonderful sense of chance that you find in a bookstore, where you pick up a book that you would never have picked up before, and what I love about that picking it up is that it's happened to me so many times.
I know that you've been a writer since childhood.
I feel this sense of being haunted by words. I mean, by hearing words come into my mind. The first word of this book was unexpected. While in prison, I received a dictionary. And I didn't really want to write about the fact of incarceration or about dictionary, but I couldn't refuse, you know, I couldn't refuse that sentence. And so a writer is then, in a way, sentenced to carry out the dictates of the first hum in the brain.
You and Ann Patchett and several other writers have owned bookstores. The bookstore in this book is particularly haunted because it's a bookstore that specializes in Native American writing. Now, I'm not sure. I think we call Native Americans indigenous peoples now. And there have been in our vocabularies so many changes, some of them trivial, but many of them very important. And one of the characters in this book begs the person she's talking to stop calling her indigenous. That's not what she calls herself. What do you call yourself?
I call myself anything. I answer to anything. You know, this character is Tookie, and Tookie is the one who says, while in prison, I received a dictionary. It's said to her by a non-Native woman who has become sort of politicized, and so is trying to impose this political vocabulary upon a Native woman who sometimes calls herself an Indian, sometimes calls herself indigenous, but most often calls herself by her tribal designation. So I would call myself Anishinaabe, and I would call myself a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. So all 576 plus tribal nations in the United States have a different word for who they are. And most of the time, the word means the people. You know, the people within those tribal designations have then, within those blanket terms, terms for family or for bands, like I would be Pembina Band. So there's all these all these identity markers within those large umbrella words. So Tookie also might call herself a criminal. There's all kinds of identities she assumes. And a bookseller. And she says, you know, that she's rehabilitated, but she also does admit that she loves lying to people. And it's very hard for her to not pilfer the till and make away with what she wants from the bookstore. She is always going to have this sort of larcenous nature.
She's fascinating, and I identified with her deeply, Louise, because...
Did you?
Oh, absolutely. I had years and years and years ago a problem, which I'm happy to say I no longer have. It was, as you mentioned with Tukey, it was the problem of lying. Lying came so instinctually to me. It was crazy. And the character Tukey is an extraordinary version of this. You say that many of the names mean the people. I grew up Jewish, which meant I had the privilege of learning the Hebrew language. And in that language, that word occurs that people use all the time. The word is goy. And I thought it was an offensive word, but the truth is that all it means is stranger or foreigner. In other words, not one of your people. And there's so much in your book, The Sentence, that is a revelation of how Native peoples bind together, read together, but most important, it seems to me, are learning their own and each other's languages together. That is an amazement to me. Have you learned any of the indigenous languages yourself?
Yes. I've been struggling for, I say, half my life to learn Ojibwe-Mawin, which was in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most difficult language to learn for quite a while because of its perfect storm of verbs and verb forms. It's a language, as you might guess, that's quite low on nouns because this comes out of a people who made many beautiful objects but had very few things. And we're always giving them away. So this language, which my grandfather spoke, which I heard, and which was really discouraged during the boarding school era, so that my mother, for instance, did not learn it, has been revived by my daughter. My daughter, Persia, whose Ojibwe name is Netan Nimid Amoikwe, has become an immersion teacher. So that means she teaches only in Ojibwe. And she and her cohort of teachers are instructing children who are then speaking to those who are the elders. And the ones in between, they are not the first language speakers. So Persia is now teaching her young son, who is only 1.5. She's immersing him in Ojibwe. And his first words are in Ojibwe. So I've started all over with the language. I've been taking it so that I will be one of those elders who can speak to my grandchild and to my daughter. She's way beyond me.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking to a writer who is beloved to me. We're talking about Louise Erdrich's new book, The Sentence. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Louise Erdrich about her new book, The Sentence, an expertly crafted story of a haunted bookstore in Minneapolis. And I just want to tell you, Louise, that my grandma lived with us. She spoke really only Russian and Yiddish. And so we invented a nonsense language between ourselves. She taught me everything that I know about morality, about goodness, about strangeness, because she herself came from a family of readers. They weren't religious people or rabbis. They were Russian mystics. And my grandma, who used to squeeze fresh orange juice every morning with seven oranges, could juggle seven oranges in the air at once. And I grew up adoring her. And I feel that very centrally in this book. There's the struggle of the characters to know who they are, who are their friends. And there are even some people who are not Native Americans who are so yearning to identify with something that one of them becomes the haunter of the bookstore, Birchbark Books, in Louise Erdrich's novel, The Sentence. She's an amazing woman because she dies in the middle of a book, in the middle of a sentence that becomes of enormous importance in this book, in which the characters are, among other things, inventing their own languages, publishing their own books, discovering the things that are part of their ancestry that no one has ever taught them. I find this, you know, all of your books have managed to thrill me, but I found this because of its basis in reading and bookstores to be the book of yours that I read most eagerly and with the profoundest identification.
I'm so happy to hear that. What a joy it is to talk. Thank you. I'm going to go back to before the break when you were talking about the word in Hebrew for stranger, not one of us, because people may not know, but in every tribal language all through the world, there is a word for the stranger, the one who came in, and it's not always identifiable by skin color at all. For instance, in Ojibwe, it's Chimokaman, or the Chimokamanuk. And that means the people with the long knives. In other tribal languages, it will be something like the people who eat the fat. So that means the people who are the greedy ones. Every tribal nation has a different and traditional language with a different term. So growing up, as you did, really, I think it was so illuminating to me, because I always feel that when I'm talking to you, that I'm talking to someone who has a knowledge of ancestors, who's had this kind of, I don't know, it's a richness of reference, and it's beyond books. But to know someone who juggled seven oranges, my father juggled into his 90s. The ghost is a very complicated woman. And you would think that as a spirit, she appears on All Souls Day, when I kept starting this book because I was superstitious about starting it then. That's the day she appears. And that is the day As I've always heard, that the world is thinnest. This is in, and I believe that the Irish have a sense of places in the world where there is a thin veil between the living and the dead.
My grandma still appears to me in my dreams and talks to me, and it's the greatest honor in the world to be spoken to by an ancestor. You know, I know as a result, I think I know all about the heavenly throne room, although I'm sure she puts that knowledge into my dreams. Do you feel addressed by your ancestors?
I dream of my grandfather. His heavenly throne room is often a high school gym. Uh-huh. I don't know why, but he's, and there's always a lot of people around. It's like he's going to conduct a ceremony, but for the opening of a high school basketball game or something like that. And so ceremonies, tribal ceremonies take place all the time. We have a song for everything. And one of my teachers said, even for changing a light bulb, how many Ojibwe does it take to change a light bulb? One to sing and the other to change it. This connection that you have, it speaks to me so deeply. I wish I dreamed more often. I don't dream while I'm writing. I feel that the dreams go into the writing somehow, but I miss that. I miss the dreaming.
Well, you've reached the point between a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize, and this book is appearing very soon on the New York Times bestseller list. You've reached the point, I think, that writers reach when they are essentially living or dead our own ancestry. And the marvelous thing to me about your books is how deeply they seem to speak to me about the things that we all lose. We lose our ancestors, we lose our languages, and everything turns into mystery. And in this book, the sentence, everything is haunted.
We can't bring our ancestors back, but dreams. That's at least some connection. And that's also why we have books, because when we lose people, when we lose writers, we at least have this tracing of consciousness or art or anything that is made and created out of the human spirit. You know, we have tracings of consciousness.
One of the great things about writers, and I know that you're among them, is that when someone, quote unquote, gets it, the gratitude on the writer's part is so enormous that it shapes the book for future readers.
It does. That's exactly the way to put it. And I think that's why so many writers look forward intensely to speaking with you. And I've listened to your podcast, so I know how the writer is feeling understood in a way that is extraordinary to our times. And I think this happens when someone turns a key in a review, for instance, or what you do is turn a key, and it unlocks something new about the book that the writer hasn't even thought of. And that is a wonderful moment. And that happens when I'm talking to you.
Well, Louise, I feel very, very grateful to you for saying that. It means a great deal to me. If you'll only speak to a writer as another human being, as someone who has experiences, some of which went into the book, others are still haunting the air around the book as readers read it.
Yes, it's really true. I mean, I keep notebooks and keep objects and things that belong in the book so that when I'm done, the book itself has a context that never really appears in the book. You're so right about that. And I don't know how you knew that, but those things are all around the book. And I know too that this sort of thing is surrounding each of my favorite books, that there's an entire life lived from which every sentence arises. And to know that that's what's happening is almost too much for one person. You know, so that's how I sometimes feel being in a bookstore. Well, it's too much for one person, but I'll just sit here and try to take in what little I can.
I'll tell you, Louise, you're filling me, I mean it literally, with so many dozens of feelings and ideas and images that come to me. This is always true of you and of your books. I'm talking with Louise Erdrich, the author most recently of The Sentence, published by Harper. And I can only thank you very deeply for joining me again.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. I'm delighted. And I also will think about the fact that you dream about departed writers. And one day, maybe I will be lucky enough to dream about departed writers too.
I want to tell my listeners that due to the pandemic, we are each taping remotely from one another, so you may hear us trying to speak at the same time. You may hear unusual sounds. By the way, you can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at all podcast services and on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. If you haven't already, won't you become a KCRW member? I know that you'll be hearing about Louise's book everywhere, but you won't hear a conversation like this one. KCRW is the place where we have created a staff of DJs and interviewers who are truly deeply involved in the things we talk about, the things we listen to, the things we say. Special thanks to Bookworm Show collaborators, my dear friends, Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan. And engineer John Meek joins us for the first time today. Our regular engineer is PJ Shahamat, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again, please, next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.